Launched a successful magazine? Why not take the next logical step and dip your toe into the world of book publishing? Today, one of our favourite travel journals goes hardbound. Plus, the man who can make all your newsprint dreams come true and a food publication to whet the appetite. All that ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Now, regular listeners will be familiar with Liz Schaefer. She's the woman behind the handsome travel publication Lodestar's Anthology and a good friend of the show. Now, Liz has raised her print game yet higher. Pathways is a book exploring 12 of the most memorable paths and trails traversed by Lodestar's Anthology writers and photographers since the magazine's launch back in 2014. Here's Liz in conversation with this programme's producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Liz, pleasure to welcome you again here in studio. But this time, well, it's still related to Lodestar's Anthology, but it's a book inspired by the magazine. Tell us about when did you decide to launch a book?
Well, we were approached by a very lovely Swedish company called New Heroes and Pioneers who'd seen the magazines and liked what we were doing with travel and thought that a book might be a fun thing to do together. So we spent a couple of months sort of playing around with ideas and working out what we wanted to do and have decided on a theme called Pathways. So the book is made up of 12 chapters. I had to cast my mind back there. 9 of which are a sort of a pathway or a journey explored in one of the magazines, but reshot and rewritten. About using our existing contributors. And then 3 of those pathways are places that won't get a magazine anytime soon that we really wanted to explore.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I was surprised when I was reading the book, there's a chapter for Bermuda, correct?
Who doesn't want to go to Bermuda?
Yes, I would like to go on a pathway there.
I mean, the one challenging thing with doing a country per issue is you have so many places you want to explore and you have to schedule them for 2 years down the track, and it just seems too long to wait, really. So
I know you have your contributors as well, but from those pathways, you've done quite a few of them, right, I presume?
Oh, like, I'm a travel junkie. If I can get on a plane and go somewhere, I'll do it. But yeah, I wrote the text for 3 of the chapters, but one of those writing samples was just writing about a photographer's work, so I didn't actually get to pop back to Australia for that one. No, we've used as many of our contributors as possible. A lot of them are people that we've used over a couple of magazines. So it's really nice to sort of go back to places that we loved the first time and revisit them with the team that we have now and the knowledge and the experience that we have now, because it's quite a different experience.
You were talking about travel. I was wondering, you know, because of Lodestar's Anthology, you have to travel, poor you, you know, because of work. But is it stressful or do you manage to relax when you're doing some research for the magazine as well?
An interesting question.
Yeah.
Oddly, for a travel writer, I'm a little bit scared of planes and I get very bad jet lag. Otherwise, I adore everything about travel. But when you are doing it for a magazine, it is a different experience. You are always switched on. You're always looking for a story. You're always trying to find the best angle, something new and exciting. Fortunately for me and my contributors, we love doing that. We love being switched on and sort of trying to find something new and different. You tend to need a holiday after a Lodestar's Anthology holiday.
And where do you like actually to spend your holidays properly with no connection to the magazine?
Oh, that's a tricky one. It's been a while since I've been on a holiday. I do pop back to Australia when I can, mainly because I miss the warm weather, especially in London in November. But
or to Bermuda, why not?
It's on the list.
And another question I'd like to ask, you know, one thing that we love here about the Stack magazines, you know, that do well, Lodestar's Anthology, I mean, it's an incredible success, and now you have a book. Do you want to branch out and do other things, perhaps with the brand, like including, well, that's what you're doing now, but perhaps, I don't know, events or, yeah, I don't know, what, in terms of the business model, what's your plans for the next year, for example?
So many plans. There are so many things you want to do. I think we've been very fortunate in some of the events we've branched out and done on the book itself. It's been different companies coming to us wanting to collaborate. And that for me is the most exciting thing. It's working with others and using that sort of combined power to really get a story across and make something special and unique to both companies. So if anybody comes to us with ideas, I do tend to say yes. which is a good way to be, I think.
And of course, the magazine itself. When is the next issue coming out?
France is going to be coming out at the end of February. It's a big one.
And we hope to hear from you again. And tell us about the book. When is it going to be launched? Where can someone that is listening to The Stack now can buy a copy as well?
Well, the book has arrived with our wholesalers yesterday, actually. So everybody's pre-ordered, has got their copy in the post already. We'll be launching it officially next week, and it should be in stores in December, perfectly in time for Christmas.
Exactly. And you know, it is Christmas season, and we take it very seriously here at Monaco. What's your perfect Christmas in some ways?
It's the Australian Christmas. It's on a beach with a couple of prawns. It's perfect. But I'm actually very excited. This is the first Christmas in a long time I'll be spending in the UK, and I'm so thrilled because for so many years now I've jumped on a plane sort of mid-December to go back to Australia, and it just feels wrong to leave London at this time when the lights are out, the carols are out, everybody's so happy to be here. So I'm quite excited to have a nice cold Christmas.
I have to say, I will also do a staycation this year because I usually go to Brazil as well. Perhaps I could do one of the paths in the book for England, I believe, which is around Cornwall, right? It looks quite beautiful.
It is quite beautiful. I was quite jealous of the team that went out there. It's just, Cornwall for me is very, very Australian. You sort of see this beautiful sea and these beautiful coasts and these little communities that seem so untouched by time. It's a very magical corner. I think every pathway I've done, we chose because they resonated with us in some way, and Cornwall was just such a standout from the England issue. Then we had the Isle of Skye from Scotland, which was just pure magic, especially coming from Australia and sort of seeing this island in the middle of the sea, and it's moody and wonderful and has this history. So every pathway is there for a reason.
Do you have any kind of reading material during the Christmas holiday? Even if you don't, I mean, if you just want to watch the telly or something, but do you have any sort of traditions like this?
I don't so much have a tradition. I think because my Christmases have always been so hot, they've been outdoors and it's very little time to sit down with anything. I am one of those people who loves to buy books and has a massive pile of books next to my bed at any one time. So hopefully I'll take a couple of days and see how much of that I can tackle.
Liz Schaefer there. Lodestar's anthology Pathways is available now from New Heroes and Pioneers. Of all the members of the print family, newspapers have had their death knell sounded most often and most vigorously. Concerning the daily variety, it's difficult to contest the harsh realities of declining circulation and advertising revenue, as more and more people seek their breaking news coverage online. But bringing you the latest scoop is just one use of newsprint. You can take things slower. Weekend and weekly editions are doing relatively better than their weekday counterparts. For many brands and individuals looking to make a statement in print, newsprint's versatility and affordability makes it an obvious starting point. One only perhaps needs to look at the Monocle Winter Weekly on all good newsstands right now. Gareth Williams is a man who understands all of this, and that's why he set up The Newspaper Club. It's a company that lets organisations and individuals make and print their own newspapers. Here's Gareth in conversation with Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan.
Gareth, thanks so much for joining me in the studio to talk about Newspaper Club, your company. What is it?
We help anyone and everyone to make their own newspaper. We use the web to really aggregate lots of orders and make it worthwhile for large traditional lithographic newspaper printers plus digital newspaper printers to do any sort of size of job, really, from one copy up.
And how did the company begin? And I wonder, why the particular focus on newsprint?
Well, the company began a few years ago, and it was the brainchild of a group of people who believed that the digital world shouldn't really abandon the sort of so-called legacy assets of the previous generation, and that there was scope to use the web to repurpose some of these things. And they thought, well, what if we could use the web to make newspaper printing accessible to everyone? You know, sort of one of the original missions of the web, really. And it turned out that that was quite popular. People really did want to print newspapers, and it started off as something of a project. And I actually got involved at the point where the founders decided that there was actually a business here and they wanted to go from it being a sort of project to more of a full-fledged business. And that was back in 2010.
And I'm interested, you say that the original idea, even before it became a full business, was that something would be lost if, as you put it, the assets of legacy media, the physical assets even, the knowledge and the materials that are involved in printing newspapers were lost with the digital revolution. Be more specific about what would be lost, because I think that that might help us get to the core of why newspapers still appeal.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Newspapers come with this incredible heritage. I mean, they have a certain authority, they have a certain look. You know, we mustn't forget that millions of people every day pick up a newspaper and enjoy it and get something from it. And we just thought, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's not sort of dismiss it as a medium. One analogy that I often use is what happened to cinema when TV came along. It didn't totally disappear. It just found a slightly different purpose. And that's really what's happening to newspapers. You know, they're used more occasionally, I think, you know, than they were. And yet they still do have some sort of special qualities to them. They're actually, if you think about it, highly evolved technology. I mean, over generations, if not hundreds of years, they evolved to communicate really clearly, to be cheap to print, but quite sturdy. You know, the paperweights are really actually very considered. The graphic design, the layout is actually, again, quite considered and has a lot of impact still.
So what kind of projects have you dealt with? What are people using newsprint for now?
Well, we think that if you want to print something, you should think about whether it might be good as a newspaper. And we have, I think, one of the most diverse customer bases I've ever come across in business. We work with really, really big corporates, big brands like Liberty of London we've just done a job for. We work for restaurant groups. We work with Yo Sushi, printed a new menu, which sort of incorporated a magazine about Tokyo. We work, perhaps surprisingly, with really big tech companies. We've done work for Dropbox, for Facebook, for Zendesk, for MailChimp, for YouTube. And what they're looking for is a format to sort of take people away from their daily routine, something that they're going to read with sort of fresh eyes. And they've used newspapers for lots of different purposes, both internally and externally. We also do the other end of the spectrum in terms of size. We do lots of art projects. We work with photographers, designers who want, say, a catalogue or a portfolio, or there's some sort of project they want to promote. One job we did this year, which was really interesting, we printed a newspaper for the New York Times Magazine to support an exhibition they were doing about the history of design with the New York Times. And they used a beautiful salmon pink newspaper to show off the different typographies and looks that the magazine had achieved over the years and the newspaper had achieved over the years. My sister-in-law, for instance, she put a newspaper together to celebrate the wedding of a friend. So we're personal projects, non-commercial projects, all the way up to really, really quite big jobs, you know, for big companies.
I'm interested in those big jobs. You mentioned that you've done work for digital companies, so Facebook. I think you've also worked with Spotify, is that correct?
Yes, we work with Spotify as well, yeah.
And for these companies, they have huge digital reach, even on their own platforms. If Spotify or Facebook want to communicate with almost the entirety of their users, they can do so simply by posting a message through their own app. So from their perspective, what specific value is added in creating and distributing a newspaper which is going to reach far fewer people, is going to be relatively more expensive for them, although, of course, a drop in the water in terms of the kind of revenue that they're coming up with? Why bother for them?
It takes people out of their daily routine. You know, if you want people to really consider what they're reading and perhaps read it with a clearer mind than they would do if it was digital, then newspaper works very well. Also, you know, we're bombarded with digital information. Change of pace sometimes helps you sort of absorb more. I think lastly, I mean, an example, think of MailChimp. We did a newspaper for them that was used at recruitment fairs. I mean, recruitment fairs are places where having something to hand out is actually quite useful, and it does differentiate you from everyone else. And they actually had a lot of fun as well, MailChimp in particular, you know, making their newspaper. It was really lighthearted. It really marked them out as different as an employer, someone that you'd want to work with. Of course, you can have fun online, but, you know, going back to the heritage, newspapers have got this incredibly deep history of entertaining people and being a bit cheeky. And I think people still react to that.
You also have a news agent on your website. So you sell a selection of the products that you have printed. Would you describe this as being symptomatic of a wider pattern of barriers being broken down between editors, printers, distributors, retailers in the print industry?
I don't know about barriers being broken down, but I think, you know, our goal there was to allow anyone to become a newspaper publisher. What it does, because you can print one copy at a time and actually sell one copy at a time, it means you need not only no assets in that we're managing the printing process, but you actually need no working capital. You know, you don't have to fund a print run to start selling newspapers. And we thought that was really exciting. You know, just through your browser, through your kitchen table, anyone can become a newspaper mogul. And that's, I think, just a classic example of, you know, what we've seen in other sectors of the web, just making people have a lot more direct relationship with end users by disintermediating various sort of stages of the process.
Is the large traditional legacy national newspapers loss the indie newspaper publishing world's gain in that regard?
National newspapers are still enormous, and, you know, we're still a small company. But I see some of the... So any sort of shift in demand from national papers to us is infinitesimally small, really. But what I think is interesting is that we're part of... You know, we're sort of demonstrating that there is a future role for newspapers, but it's one that isn't necessarily a daily role. It's about having something special to say. I mean, I've noticed myself, and anecdotally, I hear it a lot, and also it's actually reflected in daily newspaper sales. I tend to buy a newspaper now on a Saturday and sometimes on a Sunday, and really enjoy going offline and consuming that in a very different way from the way I consume news throughout the week. So I think newspapers and newsprint generally will find its level. And it will find its own niche, and it will be distinctive and different from its historical one, really.
So we met at the Stack Awards, and you were involved in a supporting capacity there. What was the involvement of your company?
We printed the brochure for the evening, and we were able to profile the nominees, so give people more information that would allow them to mull things over, take it away with them, and have some sort of record of the evening.
And yeah, so I should mention the Stack Awards is an annual independent magazine awards. Mm. I'm interested, do you involve yourself with or support small run indie print industry stuff more generally?
I think we have a really good relationship with Steve Watson, the excellent man who runs Stack, and also with Jeremy and Leslie of Mag Culture. And we get on so well with them, I think, because we're really participating in the same venture, which is exploring and getting excited and supporting people expressing themselves in print. I mean, with respect to independent magazines, we've had a few people that have started printing with us in newsprint. They've actually sort of graduated, if you like, to the glossier world of magazines. I mean, newsprint, it's highly evolved to be very economic. And so if you wanted to start a magazine, it's not a bad idea to start off, but, you know, with a newspaper rather than commit to the more expensive print runs of the sort of glossy stuff that, you know, the magazines are made of.
And finally, what do you think the future holds, both for the Newspaper Club in particular, but also about the interaction between the internet and online-based communities and print communities and projects more generally?
We're growing nicely. We've been profitable for a few years now, and I see no reason why that's not going to trundle on ahead. We're growing very rapidly in the US at the moment, which is quite exciting. But we ship all around the world. I mean, we even ship to Australia. With respect to sort of newsprint overall, I just think we're just going to increasingly see it settling down alongside digital. The big tech companies we talked about earlier are demonstrating that, you know, you move quite comfortably from digital to physical, and what you use really depends on what impact you want to make, you know, how you want to communicate. So I think, you know, in a few decades' time, you know, newsprint will be a bit like the cinema industry is now. It'll be quite big still, but it will be doing a very different thing from what it was doing back in the 20th century.
That was Gareth Williams speaking to Henry Rees-Sheridan. Find out more about the Newspaper Club at newspaperclub.com, and find out more about the Monocle Winter Weekly at monocle.com. You're listening to The Stack. Finally, on today's programme, it's time to bring you part two of our interview with David Lane, editor of The Gourmand, a food journal that really does look good enough to eat. Here's Dave on what to expect from the magazine in 2018, the latest issue, and why they've expanded to dog calendars.
It's issue 10, so it was quite a big one for us. I think we always had that in the back of our mind, and it sort of forced us to make it even better, I'd like to think.
A hard task indeed. How did you and your team go about doing that then, as you hit double figures?
You know, whenever we were talking about content, it was kind of, this is going to be issue 10, is that going to be worthy of it? And it's never, we try and avoid things that are timely, so that wasn't so much of a problem. But we were just extra harsh on ourselves, I think, with vetting and ideas. And as a result, there were lots of things in the mix early on, and then things sort of slowly got culled together.
Whittled,
exactly. Yeah. Delicately whittled.
And then we're left with the sort of beautiful fillet, as they would say, on the other side of the pond. What are some of your favourites? I know it's a tough question. It's a mean question to ask.
Let me get the contents open and I can refresh my memory. So on the cover, we've got IRL emojis. It's nice to have one thing in each issue that, you know, Instagram's going to love. And it was incredibly fun to do. I think we like doing things that maybe seem like quite obvious ideas, but unless they're executed really, really, really well, they don't really hold up. So we worked with an amazing food stylist, Seika Hatfield, and a brilliant photographer that I work with a lot, Mathieu Levanchin. They're just, they're quite amazing things.
They're really almost too perfect, and that's not easy to achieve. As
yeah,
we know.
Exactly. It's interesting that this seemed to be the optimum size, the size that they appear on the cover. We've got a grid of four. We did audition individual ones, but there was something about them being bigger that you sort of lost the obvious link to it being an emoji.
Yeah.
Any smaller and they just look like the real thing. So that's a kind of nice optimum size. Other content we've got, we did a lovely piece with Rod Stanley and a photographer, Ben Rayner, in New York, which was, we've been talking a lot about cities that were sort of truly 24-hour in terms of food, and New York's obviously right up there, and which, you know, music is an industry that definitely would take advantage of that. So they ate out with a whole handful of really interesting New York-based musicians in their favourite restaurants all around the clock, from when people were leaving rehearsals in the middle of the night to gigs and breakfasts and all sorts of things. So there's a great spread and some fantastic people in there. There's a piece on a little place in Silicon Valley called Bucks of Woodside, which was run by Steve Jobs' handyman and was the first ever cafe in Silicon Valley, really. So by default, all these deals happened. He was the first of five bloggers in the world.
There you go.
And I don't think he's changed his website since.
Okay, that's good.
But he's pictured with a shirt with a multicoloured Scrabble board on it. That kind of sums up his vibe.
Definitely, yeah.
We did a piece on restaurants in London that were over 100 years old.
Very nice.
There's lots of great people in it. Shep Gordon of Supermensch film fame and almost inventing the celebrity chef. We did a piece with him in his house in Hawaii. I Love Mackinnon is a really interesting... There's quite a lot of music, actually, in here. Andrew Logan, we did Olaf Breuning, the artist. A thing about food rituals around death. Brick Start did a memoir of Friars Club in Hollywood, where she'd go with her grandparents back in the day. So it's like, as always, diverse...
It's positively brimful.
That's just... We've just touched on the...
Just scratching the surface.
Yeah.
And tell me a bit about the kind of... The whole world of Gourmand, because, I mean, here at Monocle, it's the same. It's... Sure, there's a magazine sort of at the heart of everything, but there's all sorts of other tentacles, aren't there?
Yeah.
And you're stretching your tentacles all the time, David. Tell us about that journey for the Gourmand.
For issue 10, we've relaunched the website, and we really wanted to just make some more out of the fantastic content that we've created. So we've launched Gourmand Editions, which are limited edition art prints. They're really short run, so each image is an edition of 30, and they're signed and numbered by the artist, and you can get them on the website. So just lots of people get in touch about the imagery and say, you know, I'd love to own one. How can I do it?
And now's your chance.
And now you can.
Yeah.
So we're going to launch 6 of those every 3 months throughout the year. So there's a nice diverse range of imagery, and they're going really well. And we're also selling various other things online, like our dog calendar, which we do every year. This year's for the RSPCA. Exclusively features dogs named after foods.
Okay.
So you can see...
I remember some of them.
You can see biscuit paired with a cup of tea and pickle lily with a piece of cheese.
I mean, can you afford not to acquire one.
No,
listeners,
I say no.
I
think they may have sold out already, but
double check.
We can reprint them again.
Okay.
And it's all for a good cause. And someone can even, honey, the staff is looking for a home. So.
Oh, there you go. Come on. At this time of year, this is when we must think. We must think of others, including needy staffies.
The dog calendar is not just for Christmas as well.
There you go.
It's for the whole year. So.
Good stuff. And what about into 2018, I guess, Dave? I mean, it's always good to get your sense of the future. I mentioned earlier, but before we started recording, you know, you're a man who wears many hats. What's exciting? What's on the horizon? And, you know, how optimistic are you? We like to get a nice sense of optimism for the year ahead, whether it's about your now venerable title, I would say, independent publishing, all these kind of things. What's kind of dominate? What's on the landscape as you look ahead?
Well, I'm still working with Freeze, which is fantastic, and I'm really enjoying that. So we've got 8 issues of Freeze next year and 1 of Masters, which is great. There's a brilliant team. We, at the Gourmand, we are looking at expanding from just the magazine into publishing some other things, which may not be periodical as such. So we're looking at doing some books and things, and we're quite early stages, but it's been something we've been working on for a long time.
It was only a few short weeks ago, you and I were both obviously at our near namesake Stack Magazines. We were at their Stack Magazine Awards. It was really striking to me that there were so many brilliant, I mean, there were so many brilliant things being recognised, as you'd expect, on a shortlist and amongst the winners. But I was reassured by how many great student titles there were, how many great new launches there were.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like the momentum behind this kind of independent publishing boom is slowing up at all. If anything, it appears to be gaining pace. Is that the sense you get as well?
Yeah, definitely. I was also really encouraged by the fact that, you know, it's easy to think of independent publishing as being something done by really young people. And actually, a lot of people that won awards are people that have been doing fantastic magazines for a long time. Mm. And it was really nice to see that acknowledged as well. I mean, iMagazine have been going for, I think, almost as long as Freeze, like 25 years or something. Mm. And, you know, it's very difficult to keep an independent magazine going. So it's lovely to see those people being acknowledged. I think Roulette won an award. Like there were lots of titles there that have been around for a long time.
Heritage titles.
Yeah, and haven't
say.
Been swamped by a new wave of stuff, but have actually been kind of spurred on by it.
Well, and still super innovative. I mean, it was funny, you mentioned that and we talked about that on this programme a couple of weeks ago. Incredibly innovative in terms of the cover idea they had. I mean, it sounds like one of those vainglorious ideas that the creative director would have and the publisher would say, no.
Yeah.
But they did it. And to have been around for so long, but to still be really surprising and pushing the boundaries is a testament to that,
definitely,
that team, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think, like, things about design is a bit of a difficult area. I mean, I personally find it a bit tricky. I find design about design a bit strange.
Yeah.
And normally design's only as interesting as the thing that it's talking about. And they managed to talk about design in a fantastic, well-researched, well-read way. Mm. And there's a direct lineage to lots of other great people working in magazines, back to especially Simon Eston and people there. So, yeah, I think to have both ends of the spectrum represented, you know, great student magazines, lots of new titles that I had never heard of. I love going to the Stack Awards because, like, solely for the reason I find out about sort of 10 or so great magazines.
That was David Lane from the Gourmand. Issue 10 is available on all good newsstands. Right now, to hear Dave's tips on Christmas cooking and eating, do remember to find last week's edition of The Stack, broadcast live from the Monocle Christmas Market. Find it and so much more about all of our great programmes at monocle.com. That's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our production team of Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rees-Sheridan, and our editors Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. If you have any comments or queries, do drop Fernando a note. He can be found at FE for Fernando Pacheco at monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.